All right, quieting down now. Live from the Brit and Yankee Pub Studios. Another Brit and Yankee craft beer pubcast. I can hear the pints being pulled right now. Take it away, lad. You are paying for that beer, aren't you?
Pump up the bitter. Pump up the bitter.
Yep, it's another pubcast from the Brit and Yankee. We have once again hit the road. This time I'm with my good friend and co-host, Mr. Ken McMullen from Hot Vine Brewing.
Buenos dias, Phil.
Buenos dias. Welcome to this show, because I drove you out west. We've come west on I-88.
Straight west.
Straight west. Nice. And we are actually doing something a little bit different this time around. We're going to be doing a distillery / brewery. Of course, we are still going to have great beers in front of us, but we want to explore some of the harder liquor that's coming from Rochelle, Illinois. And I'm very happy to say we are at Kenne Farms Distillery. Anything else on that?
And brewery.
Okay. Sure. And with me, sitting across from me, is Doris Kenne.
Correct.
And
Rick Kenne.
Rick Kenne. Now, I was thinking it was Kenny, but it's Kenne, right?
We actually go by Kenny.
You go by Kenny? Okay, all right. Well, that makes it easier, because for dimwits like me who can't pronounce, you know. So thank you guys for having us out here. And I first of all should say that when you come to Rochelle, it's a very, shall we say, sleepy town. I mean, this is a Thursday afternoon. It's 25 degrees and freezing cold outside. Mm-hmm. So there's not a lot going on at the moment. But when you go down the main street, there's this old theater. And when you look through the doors, it's not a theater. It's a distillery and a brewery. And we're sitting upstairs in the tap room. So first of all, tell us a little bit about this building, because this is an amazing setup that you have here.
Thank you. Well, first of all, thank you for coming to see us today. We're thrilled to have you. We're sitting in the historic Hub Theater. It was started in 1926 and finished in 1931. And was a live theater initially, and then in the 50s became a movie theater. Somewhere
so
in the
vaudeville
70s
perhaps. Yes. Early days.
Absolutely.
And does Rick do a little song and dance from time to time?
Not at all. Oh,
only in private.
Okay. Oh, hey. So how long was it lying obsolete before somebody had the brilliant idea of turning it into something really useful?
Sure.
It was like most downtowns. When the interstates were built, they bypassed a lot of the downtowns. So, you know, it fell on some hard times starting in the mid-70s, and it was on and off operated as a movie theater for the ensuing 20 to 25 years. Starting in the mid-90s, it was probably closed more than it was open, mm-hmm. and then permanently closed
2011, I believe.
Yeah. Hmm. Yeah.
And you may get a little echo on this one, because it's quite cavernous, right, Ken? I mean, the ceiling is
We're basically sitting where, if this had a balcony, we'd be in the balcony looking back towards where the screen would have been.
Correct.
But what we're looking at is an astounding array of large fermenters, and I guess you've got mash tons? Or we'll get into the distilling side of it, I think, in just a little bit.
Sure.
But as we look at it, there's also these magnificent, what look to be copper tubes with little portholes in them. Any idea what that is, Ken?
Those are the stills.
Oh, they're the stills. I thought that was like a curly thing. Although I'm going off moonshine here, so you're not doing moonshine. So so I guess what we should do while we're chatting about what all this equipment and how this all works, because this mm-hmm. is the first time I've been in a real big distillery, is to try one of your beers. Now, can you tell us what we have here?
What we have here is the Mother Hen. It's a Hefeweizen. It's brewed with local hops from Livewire out of Dixon, Illinois, two local gentlemen that started that company. It's a hibiscus flower. It's got a brilliant floral flavor. and the color is representative of the dynamic women in our family.
Oh.
Name actually
they're
comes...
They're all copper-colored? Or
how
what?
About that? I like to think of it as strawberry blonde.
Oh, there you go.
Which, of course, is all of us girls have a little strawberry blonde in our hair. The name the mother hen comes from back when the kids were young and they would be at the farmhouse and we would have the CB radios. Mom would be in the tractor. So I was the mother hen, and I would call back to the hen house, make sure they were doing their chores and their homework and things like that, until they got too old and they said it was too embarrassing. I couldn't call over the radio and ask them those things anymore.
Would there be other people listening in on like,
absolutely.
CB radio?
Yes. I mean,
that's like the trucking thing, right?
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. All the neighbors could hear.
Yeah. So this is a real family enterprise that
absolutely.
You have going here.
Yes.
Obviously,
yes.
You guys have been in on it. Who else from your family is involved?
Right now, obviously, it's my wife, myself.
My son Caleb.
He does all of the grain production, and then my nephew does my distilling for us. My daughter Aubrey, you've met already. She does all of the marketing and the PR work, mm-hmm. and my wife does most of the legal work.
Bookwork.
Yeah.
What I call the boring things.
Yeah.
So were you a farming family by trade, or did you do other things before coming into the distilling business?
No, we're fifth generation farming. My daughter's sixth generation, and my son, obviously. And our grandson was just born, and hopefully he'll be the seventh. So, yes, it's a farm family. We can easily go back to the 1860s, probably 1850s, and trace the family from there. Great-grandmother was, on my dad's side, was Irish. Great-grandmother was German. How they came to Northern Illinois, not real sure, but they did come to Northern Illinois, met, and, had...
Are you on the same farm from back then?
We are not on the same farm.
No.
The farm is over about two roads over to the west is where the original farm
so
was.
So from
at.
Where we are now, it's two roads west of here.
Actually,
how big is it?
Actually, where our home farm is located in Ashton, it would be two roads to the west from there. So.
And how many acres?
What was that at the time?
Well, the home farm right where we live is about 600 acres, right?
Oh, wow.
Right where we live. And then we rent some other acres in the area.
So you are producing predominantly what that you're using, I'm assuming, in your brewery slash distillery?
Our bourbon is about two-thirds corn. Which we produce all of our own corn, and the remainder, depending on what we're doing that day, is either rye or barley or a combination of them both. We've made a rye whiskey, which is predominantly rye, obviously, mm-hmm. and the rest of that is wheat and corn. So that's predominantly what we raise and what we... And it is in the ingredients in our rye whiskey and our bourbon.
And so, Ken, of course, the predominant grain in beer is barley.
Right.
Right, so...
But it's malted, and that's probably... They're probably not using their own barley because they don't have a maltster because of where we live.
Correct.
Okay. So it's easier to grow corn around here, obviously. This is one of the corn belts, right? That in Iowa.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's easy, but it's...
Well,
mostly done.
Well, wait a minute. It's easy. You just plant the seeds and then they grow up. Yeah. Nothing else that has to happen.
Yeah,
we just,
that was just.
I'm told sure you guys are like, yeah, it's easy.
But some of the other ingredients are from other local farmers mm-hmm. that we know that, are able to provide those inputs for us.
Yeah, so. Particularly you said the hops, which is really interesting because
absolutely.
We went to another. Farm / brewery down in Fairbury, mm-hmm. Illinois, and Emancipation Brewing.
Okay.
If I had my sponsor's bell, I'd ding,
ding, ding, ding,
ding. We always give kudos to other people who've done a show with
sure.
us or one we like. And they do grow a few hops on their own farm.
Wow.
But You know, is that something you might want to consider for the future, or are you going to leave that to the people who know how to grow the hops?
Maybe, but it's way off in the distance of our priorities. It's what I've visited and seen them grow. It's a lot of work, a lot of hand harvesting, a lot of specialized machinery that I don't have excessive amount of time on my hands or the correct machinery. So it'd be a ways off.
Yeah, okay. So going back to Mother Hen, the beer that we've been supping on,
sure.
it does have that nice Hefeweizen aroma to it. Is that's called esters, right?
Yeah, you might get banana esters, you might get a little clove phenols.
But when you go to taste it, number one, it's beautifully light and crisp. Number two, I definitely get that floral from it.
Yeah, that is.
And the color, I mean, I don't think I would have known this was a Hefeweizen unless you told me, but, you know.
Well, I'm guessing, I mean, a traditional hefe uses a yeast that doesn't flocculate out, so you end up with a cloudy beer, and this is crystal clear.
Yeah.
So I'm assuming this is an American-style Hefeweizen.
I would agree. It's made from Cascade hops, for the people that follow their...
Oh, yeah, our guys do.
Yeah, and absolutely.
To be honest, we have to be a little careful. Rochelle, there's not a lot of craft distilling in this area, so we've not been open for a year, so we want to walk people into craft beer, if that makes sense to you.
Right.
So we're just, if ours beer is a little more traditional, that it's kind of done on purpose.
And that, in my opinion, is absolutely perfect, because I think there's so many of these brewers that are opening up with the adjunct heavy or the newer styles. And
well, I think you're getting that in urban centers.
Yeah.
But, you know, this is like down in Bloomington. I mean, there's some hazies going on down there. It's a little bit bigger town. But the towns between there and here, that's, I mean... One of the breweries that's supplying a lot of that is Evil Horse, Ding Ding, out of Crete.
Crete, Illinois, yes.
And all he's brewing is traditional stuff, because all the little bars in the, I shouldn't say little bars, all the bars in the smaller towns and the rural towns, that's what they're going through, are lagers and, you know, maybe pale ales, but it's like blonde ales and... ambers and stuff.
Sure. So, and I think you have to brew what sells, right?
It's what the old days of brewing was. You know, when you'd go into a town, you'd be educating the town about craft beer. And so you'd start with approachable beers, and then you'd gradually move into,
That's a good word.
More assertive.
Beers. Yeah. I'm going to steal that.
And the other one you can have, this I don't think is particularly heavy in terms of ABV.
No. Well, 6.1.
Oh, it's 6.1. Okay, yes. Well, that's a lot lighter tasting than it.
It's really tasty.
But yes, it's just a delightful beer.
Thank you.
This would be perfect on a summer's day. Do you have any outside facilities here, or is it all inside?
We actually do, out on our balcony outside here of the mezzanine area.
Oh, right. Okay.
Is a wonderful area to overlook the street and get that little bit of sunshine during the day when people are able to get here during the nicer weather.
So as I look that way, that's like over the street.
Mm-hmm. It is.
Was that there?
It actually was not there. There was a marquee there initially, but it was going to be very costly to repair that marquee. And we started to look at the initial photographs of this structure. There was an overhang that gave the appearance of a balcony. And so what we did was think, oh, wow, that's perfect. We'll go ahead and make it a true balcony and give it the image of what it was back in 1936. Yeah.
And that, what Doris said, this entire concept, it evolved. I mean, Doris and I had a basic idea of what we wanted. We wanted this to be the tasting room. Mm-hmm. We wanted, a viewing station. But with the architects involved and the engineers involved and a lot of smart minds, very talented people, we'd have a weekly meeting, and it just kept evolving. I said, what about this? Well, what about this? And just what you're looking at is truly what I would call an evolution of what was in our heads, So.
Yeah, and I'm assuming that you had to put up the wall that's behind the tap room bar area, which separates the actual where the work goes on, right?
Actually, at one point, a wall was there. When it became a movie theater later in time in the 70s, when they were trying to basically stay open, they made this into three theaters. Mm-hmm. So up here was one, up here in the mezzanine area, and then they split the main production, what I call now the production room, in half. So it's three different theaters here. So yes, there was a wall here at some point that was brought in and then taken away again. So.
And as I look at the wall up above is your logo, which I think goes back to there's a large female influence on this environment.
Absolutely,
right?
Yes.
A lady with a keg on her back.
Sure.
I hope it's not a full one, because if it is, she's very strong.
It's a 15-gallon one.
I think the model for that is their daughter.
Oh, right. Okay. Well,
Aubrey was definitely our inspiration for the logo, and we, knew that we wanted a female to represent our company, both because the females in our family had been very strong in agriculture, and we knew they would be in the distillery business as well. And women like bourbon, too, and we wanted to make that very, very strong that, women are in the spirits industry as well.
Right. Well, I've finished my sample of this. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll come back and talk about how exactly the turning point that you decided to do this venture.
I go to yonder holler, build me a still. Give you a gallon for a $5 bill. It's a whiskey, rah, whiskey. Whiskey, I can ride. Tree don't fall on me. I live till I die.
The second sample that we have looked absolutely delightful, with a beautiful white creamy head, kind of a slightly hazy golden color. And when I sniffed it, it wasn't at all what I was expecting. So tell us about this one. What's it called?
This is called Cakes on the Griddle, a little spin-off of John Denver's song, country song back when, and it's got a Magnum hop in this one.
What am I smelling? I mean, to me, I'm smelling cakes on a griddle. I mean, I can't believe it. It's amazing.
It's got a little bit of a waffle. Think of a...
Is there vanilla in here?
A breakfast waffle.
Maybe wow.
Is there syrup in here?
There actually is no maple syrup in here. Don just calls it a spiced ale.
Okay, that makes sense. Because I was going to say, there's some spice in this. I'm not exactly certain what it is, but man, that's really interesting. So is this a cream ale? Or is it
this is not considered a cream ale, although it is very smooth. It feels creamy, doesn't it?
I like this a lot. Actually, I like a beer when you smell it and it's not what you expect, and then when you taste it, there's a whole different story in there as well. So it's kind of interesting.
Don is our brewer. He's very creative, and we give him a lot of leeway to create basically whatever he wants to, with a little bit of a guideline. We don't want him to get too far, one way or the other, but he's very creative and comes up with really good. But now it's up to Doris and I to do the social media, to introduce them, get people to try them, and then there's a fair amount of sales, and the people behind the bar, they're fairly educated on how to sell a new beer like this one. But this one will start off a little bit slow, I'll be honest with you, but it's catching on. Every day goes by, a few more people are just starting to ask for it.
And you mentioned Don. That's Don Clapp, right?
It is.
Who is your head brewer. Is he part of the family, or
Don,
what's his story?
Don is not. He is now. Don actually worked with our nephew Adam when they first started out doing ethanol production. And when we were getting ready to put this project together, Adam was basically working up the floor plan and would ask Don, more as a friend, what do you think about this and that? This is what I'm thinking of doing. And it was during that process that Don said, you know, you really need a brewery. Mm-hmm. And, of course, we looked at him and said, are you going to be that brewer? Because that wasn't on the game plan initially. And so that was a nice addition. And then, of course, I was supposed to make sure that we could get the licensing for both. So Doris had a few sleepless nights with that.
Do you have a legal or accounting background?
I am a court reporter by trade.
Oh, right. Okay.
So about 38 years worth of court reporting, and just was the natural choice to do a lot of the legals and permitting and licensing aspects of the business.
So I have a question on that.
Sure.
I've always wondered, they seem to sit there with like three fingers and they've got like three buttons, yet they're recording absolutely mm-hmm. everything. Is it like a shorthand?
It is absolutely a shorthand. There's actually about 25 keys on there, and all 10 fingers are moving pretty quick at any given time. Yeah, it's they look a little calm on TV. It's not that calm.
How does that translate to a computer keyboard?
It's all computerized now, where you identify what you're writing, and there's brief forms. So,
what I meant was, you get used to doing like three buttons or something, but then when you come to a computer keyboard,
I see what you mean.
If you're trained that way, I mean, I don't. I'm a, you know.
It really plays havoc with your regular typing for a while,
right,
until your brain starts to realize there's a difference between the two and you're able to do both. But,
so. Okay, so let's go back now to, you know, I think you said that you worked for another company, a large chemical company, right?
Yes,
Rick?
Yes, exactly.
So you were doing the farm and working for that chemical company.
Yes.
And you were running the farm, Doris?
I was also working with the farm with Rick.
Okay. Wow, you've been busy.
And doing. So, yeah, we both had basically three jobs between us.
So at some point in the past, somebody said, hey, why don't we start a distillery, I'm assuming, was the initial idea, right?
Well, initially, we always looked for ways to add value to our grain. We've been looking, my great-grandfather probably add value to his grain. He fed his oats to his horse, and that provided the power for the farm. You know, it's just, you try to add value. And so we got into livestock in the mid-90s, and that was fairly successful. But we've tried some adding value things that, quite frankly, were not successful. So you got to fail fast and fail very cheaply. So we decided, you know, we kicked around the idea, okay, what about distilling? And, you know, we had the manpower, we had the expertise, and we know we couldn't manufacture. One thing about farming, you're good at manufacturing, you're good at making things with your hands. So the more we delved into it, the more we said, I think we could do this. So we had some local fabricators that helped us make the tanks. And from that came, you know, the stills. We obviously can't make the stills, the big copper stills, but we had to buy those. But there's a lot of things that we could incorporate our previous knowledge and previous experiences into distilling. And so it's kind of a natural evolution. It didn't come all at once, but over about a five-year period, it just kept evolving to something. I think we could do this.
So did you make moonshine on the farm?
We practice, yes.
All right.
We practice. There's some regulations on how you do moonshine on the farm, but we stayed pretty much, I think we stayed pretty much within the constraints of the laws, but yeah, we practiced on how to make it. And remember, my distiller worked at the distillery at the ethanol plant for 8 years.
Mm-hmm.
So he really understood the distillation process.
So I'm assuming that as you were growing corn, you were selling the corn to help make the ethanol.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And how, so my only experience with ethanol, I don't know about you, Ken, but it was with having a car that I, you know, back in the days when gas was really expensive, you could put E85 into your car. And that was my experience with ethanol. Do they use ethanol for anything else? Do you use it?
Do I use it?
Yeah. You don't put it in your car, right?
I put it in my mouth.
Oh, so ethanol. So is ethanol alcohol?
Yes.
That's what it is.
It's the same thing. It's
same
thing.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Same process. Yep, absolutely.
Okay. But
actually a smaller scale, if you can believe that. Or
oh.
than at the ethanol plant that is situated south of town here.
Oh, right. Okay. So this is the same process. Let's talk a little bit about distilling. Obviously, I'd like to kind of get to the point where at some point you're going to say, yes, and we're going to use the barrels for our barrel aging program a bit later on. So where do you start? What's the liquor that would be the starting liquor for a distiller?
Well, I can start with the whole process. It starts with the grain on my farm, predominantly corn, and we select it for the highest starch variety that we can possibly grow. It's cleaned on the farm. In other words, all the chaff is left on the farm, and we feed that all to the livestock, all the cracked kernels and all that. Then it's ground at the farm and then brought in here as a ground form, and that's where the distillation process really starts, is here. It's cooked in our cook tanks for a period of time, and then it's transferred to our fermenters. Yeast is added, and there's literally hundreds of different kinds of yeast you can add for different flavors, different yields, different times. It's just the time it needs to ferment. And then from that process, it's transferred to our beer well, which is about 8% alcohol at that point. From that point, it goes to our stills, and that 8% alcohol basically gets concentrated into 80% alcohol.
And if I remember rightly from what I know about it, you're boiling the alcohol, and then the condensation drips off, and
that's what you collect.
Whatever percent alcohol.
The heads and the tails you discard, the hearts you keep, and that's where the distiller really got to really understand the distillation process. What temperatures the different alcohols come off at? Mm-hmm. The lower temperatures, some alcohols just need to be discarded because it's not the alcohols you want to drink. At the higher temperatures, another set of alcohols get discarded. It's only that part in the middle is what's kept.
So they talked about yeast being different types. Are they the same types as you would use for your brewing, Ken? Or
there are distinct distilling yeasts that are used that are very aggressive, very clean fermenting. But they ferment very quickly because, we're more concerned with flavors that the yeast produce in the beer world than distillers are, generally.
Generally, yeah.
Are you getting your yeast from the same sources as the breweries are getting their yeast from?
Yes. We have yeast salesmen that stop by here.
And okay.
Yeah, all the yeast suppliers make distillers yeast too.
Yeah.
They do. Okay.
Yeah.
So what was the first one that you started producing? Because you tell me what
we made vodka first.
Okay.
Because quite frankly,
there's a big Russian population.
Big Russian population. Yeah. Everybody asked, well, is this made from potatoes? I said, no, this is made from corn. We're in the Midwest. I get asked that question probably daily.
Is Russian vodka made from potatoes then?
A lot of it is sure.
It? Oh,
I mean, depends what part of Russia you're in. If you're in the Ukraine, there's a lot of corn in the Ukraine. Obviously, that's not part of Russia, but yeah. I'm sure it's made from corn. But ours is made from 100% corn.
Okay.
Our vodka is 100% corn. It's one of the easier alcohols to make. It's the easiest one to put behind my bar here as a mixer. So that was the first one that we started off with.
Okay. And then you moved into
Dorsey, you want to take this one?
Absolutely. Gin. Gin was our number two product. I'm a gin drinker, so it had to be wonderful.
I have a question.
Absolutely.
If you have a gin and tonic, what do you put in it? A slice of lemon or a slice of lime?
Lime.
Uh-oh.
We always put lemon in. I don't know why it is. But a good gin and tonic in England is with a slice of lemon. But anyway, carry on.
In Kenny Farms Distilling Gin, you don't need a lime or a lemon. You don't even need a mixer. It is absolutely wonderful, standalone. My preference is to drink it neat, very cold and neat.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Like the vodka?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. the what we did with our gin was we wanted something very unique that would appeal to maybe more non-gin drinkers, in all honesty. Looked at several recipes, and this one was the selection. It's lighter on the juniper and heavier on the botanicals. We have a coriander, a lemongrass, a bitter orange, an orris root, and it finishes with the black pepper. And the first time that we made that selection and our nephew went to work on it, several weeks later after it had marinated and gone through its sufficient waiting time, Rick was here the day that they actually bottled that product. And it was ready to go on the shelf the next day, and I hadn't tasted the finished product yet. So I was like, hold the presses.
Uh-oh.
Quality check on this. Yeah. So he had strict instructions to bring that home that night, and I was waiting at the door with a chilled glass and did the first waft of the smell of it, and that was very, very good at initial smell, and then the taste and that finish with the black pepper. Mm-hmm. It was like he nailed it. This is awesome.
So I know that slow berries are another way of making gin. Is that okay. involved here, or you can't get slow
no.
berries? Is that something
no.
typically
we
British
do it
or
here.
What?
No.
We Adam actually used a whole juniper berry and just let it
is
soak.
Is that the same as a slow berry, or is it different?
No, they're different.
They're different, okay.
We thought about that for a while, but you know, we had to get on to other things. The vodka first, then the gin, then I'm assuming your next question is what do you make next? And that was the rye whiskey. It ages a little bit faster in the barrel, so that went in the barrel in June, right? In June of this year, mm-hmm. and now we're on to bourbon. The bourbon is what we believe will be our signature product. That's what we really wanted to be, our signature product. But it just so happens our vodka is really good. I mean, we're getting a lot of people that really like it. So it's been very popular. The gin is very unique to Rochelle because of the botanicals that we included. It's very unique to Northern Illinois and our recipe. So that's been very well received. Mm-hmm. So we're very enthusiastic with how our rye is actually, once it finishes aging, which is going to be another year and a half, maybe 2 years, we're very anxiously awaiting how it's going to taste.
So we're going to break in just a second, sure. but I caught on something you said that you had to get moving on other things. And I'm assuming you didn't make slow gin because you had to get moving.
We had to get moving. I like that. That's
all
funny.
Right. We'll be back in a second.
Okay.
Well, life on the farm is kind of laid back. Ain't much an old country boy like me can't hack. It's early to rise, early in the sack. Thank God I'm a country boy. Well, a simple kind of life never did me no harm. Raising me a family and working on the farm. My days are all filled with an easy country charm. Thank God I'm a country boy. Well, I got me a fine wife, I got me old fiddle. When the sun's coming up, I got cakes on the griddle. And life ain't nothing but a funny, funny riddle. Thank God I'm a country boy. When the work's all done.
We're back, and the next beer from the beer selection that we're leaving up to Rick and Doris to choose for us is one that I was hoping they were going to choose. And this, I believe, is your Cherries Jubilee.
It is.
Okay, which is a very, very good dessert. Is it a dessert? Yes, I'm
it
sure
is.
It's a dessert.
Yes.
yes. But tell us a little bit about this, because this okay. is, as I like to say, as black as you're at.
Well, this is a pastry stout, so you're correct in that, Bill. Phil, sorry. And it's got a cherry chocolate influence to it. It's made
it
with a magnum hops. And this will surprise you. It's 9% alcohol content.
Really?
That
wow.
does not taste like 9%.
Doesn't taste like it also doesn't taste like a pastry stout. And the reason I say that is that you're getting a lot of that nice roasty, malty, you know, the kind of flavors, and I definitely get the chocolate.
Mm.
But then the cherry gives it a slight tartness.
Mm-hmm.
Am I wrong?
Yeah, it's the body's not real heavy like a lot of pastry
right.
stouts with lactose and excess sugars. It's pretty nice.
It's
the malt character in there. Mm. It's like a nice malt backbone with with all the chocolate and the cherry.
So is this one a end of the evening favorite with people when they come in? I can't imagine having more than a snifter of this.
Well, I mean, obviously you guys know this more than I, but the alcohol content, we serve this in a 10-ounce glass.
Yep.
Okay. Yeah. I don't know if it's the end of the evening. We have a lot of people, this is what they order.
To me, it's because the body's a little lighter. You know, this does not drink like a 9% beer.
Yeah, you know what I mean, and, Phil? And I like the way you describe it. This is from your website. A high-octane stout. And I'm coming along and going, oh, I'm going to get something really good. But it's so light. You know, that I wouldn't have said it was high-octane, but I bet this one sneaks up on you. Anywho, to continue our story on the spirit side, by the way, speaking of spirits, this place isn't haunted, is it?
Being yes, an old theater, it is.
It is?
Be here at night by yourself when you're closing. It's spooky. Trust me, it just is.
Have you tracked down any of the stories of who's supposed to be here or is supposed to be here?
We have not, but we have one of our retail neighbors that has seen a picture from this building, and she swears that there's a ghost-like figure in the back of one of these pictures, and it was actually up in this corner here that we're very close to right now.
No, wait a minute, that's no ghost.
Oh, I just felt a chill.
It's Ken. What?
I just felt a chill.
Yeah.
What, blowing on your neck.
Seriously, you be here at night all by yourself and you're closing. It's, you know, 11:30, 12 o'clock. It is, it's uncomfortable.
Yeah.
It's just, that's all there is to it.
Yikes.
Okay. I see a promotion. Like a, what's the night at the museum? At the distillery?
Right. Yeah. Okay, and it's right by the employees only and the toilets. So maybe we, you know, I'll take a pee outside. Anyway, back to the spirits. So you do a rye whiskey and a bourbon. So my question is, as being a non-spirits drinker, typically I do have the odd gin and tonic, mostly when my family comes over.
With lemon.
What is the difference between a whiskey, which I know being a Scots whiskey, and that's kind of all I ever drank was a Scots whiskey, but a rye whiskey and a bourbon. What's the difference in... the main difference in the flavor, I guess they're different flavors, but
most
they
of
look
it,
the same.
Most of it's in your ingredients. A bourbon has got to be minimum 51% corn. It has to be distilled up to 130 proof. No, 130. Yeah, 130 proof, sorry. And then it has to be put in a new white oak barrel. And then it can be called bourbon. It doesn't have to be made in Kentucky. It can be made anywhere, as long as it meets those three requirements. Mm-hmm. Rye is pretty much the same way, but it has to be 51% rye. Distilled to 130, put in a new white oak barrel, and then it would be called rye. This thing of whiskey as somebody's last name, there's rye whiskey, there's bourbon whiskey, there's Irish whiskey, there's Scottish whiskey. It's kind of your last name. And then all the your first names is what I just mentioned.
I can't remember. Do you put an E in it or not? Whiskey, is it W-A-S-K-E-Y or just K-Y, I think?
I think the only one with just Y is that Canadian?
I thought that
I
was
used to
the
know
British
that
spelling
one.
Or the Scots spelling,
oh, really?
I should say.
Yeah,
I maybe it's know. The Irish spelling. I don't know.
Okay. I'm embarrassed. I don't know that.
Yeah.
So you said you put them into brand new white oak barrels.
Correct.
I know that Missouri oak is one that's used a lot for barrel making. Where do you get your fresh, clean barrels from?
Ours come from Kentucky.
Okay.
It's just a natural place because all the distilleries, most of the distilleries are in Kentucky. Yeah. It just seems like that's a place that the distilleries have bought their barrels from.
And do you have, is there like a specific cooper, I think, is a barrel maker called a cooper, right?
Mm-hmm.
Cooperages.
Cooperage. Is it the same one as some of the big boys go to? You use that?
Absolutely. Okay. Yeah. There's really two main ones in Kentucky, and we're going to use the ones that, it's one of the two largest ones. The name is, for some reason, is slipping me right now, but we are going to get our first semi-load of barrels in the last week of May, and so we have to be ready for that. So we're making the bourbon now, storing it in a stainless steel container. So when the barrels do come in, we'll fill them relatively quickly because they do dry out. So within a week, we'll fill them. So we have to have it's, I think it's 260 barrels, the 53-gallon barrels. So that comparable amount of gallons we have to have made. So when the barrels arrive, we'll fill them within a week, and then they're going to storage.
And the inside of the barrel, so my experience of barrels is that they're all used, which is typically what, you know,
what brewers are using.
For brewers, yeah. But when you get them, they're brand new. Is the inside charred?
Exactly. There's four charrings, 1, 2, 3, 4, obviously. Four being the darkest, one being the lightest. It's kind of like, I always like it when I do tours. That's how you like your marshmallows over an open fire. You want a little brown tint, or do you want it black and on fire?
Yeah, mm-hmm. that's my missus. So does that impart a different flavor or color
absolutely,
to the spirit?
Absolutely. Because your toasting is what gives us, like a piece of bread, you put it in a toaster, it tastes different than a piece of bread, right? It just does. So it imparts the different flavors, the different sugars that are in the oak barrel will come out. So we're probably going to go, not probably, we've had this discussion 1,000 times, with a number two charring, it'd be a little bit lighter. It's supposed to give a little more of a sweet flavor. But we're all very aware that light colors imparts maybe not as dark and as rich, but a darker color is just mentally you think of it, this is richer, this is darker. So there's a balancing act in there. Mm. We might go with a three. It's going to be a two or a three charring. We haven't completely made that decision just yet.
You have some already back there aging though, right?
That's the rye barrels.
Okay.
The rye ages a little quicker, mainly because when rye's got a definite, it's got a personality. Rye just has a definite flavor going in, so it doesn't need to age near as long because you don't extract as much flavor from a barrel of rye that you do a barrel of bourbon.
Mm-hmm. So do you use rye malt in any of the beers you make?
Not that I'm aware of. Again, okay. I'm not a brewer.
Yeah.
I know enough about brewing to hire the right guy that can do it.
Yeah, right. So from the perspective of, you talk about the charring, we went down to Georgetown, Illinois, and there's Big Thorn Brewing down there. And the brewer down there, he chars fresh pieces of wood that he puts into his fermenters to impart a woody characteristic to the beer. So if you didn't have that charring, and you know, maybe this is something you know, Ken, I don't know, because you've done the beer side of it, but you've put oak spirals into beer, so that imparts an oakiness. So if you didn't have, if you had a barrel that was brand new, no charring, could you put a spirit into it? I mean, assuming you could put a beer into it, or is that not a good idea because there's that charring also kind of disinfects the inside.
I think there's that. There's the disinfection part, but it's, you know, a spirit is such a strong, like, experience when you taste it. I think that the charring kind of mellows it. The stuff that goes into uncharred barrels is wine and, like, maybe mead.
Ooh.
And so you're getting more of that, like, the vanilla part of the oak.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know of any spirits that are aged in uncharred barrels.
An agave, but I'm not. Which is tequila. Yeah. I'm not real sure.
Yeah.
So have you thought about the fact that you've got this slew of barrels, and we'll talk a little bit about where you store those shortly. But you've got this slew of barrels that you're going to put out for sale in whatever length of time it is that you have to wait before you send something out. What do you do with those afterwards? Can you use them again, or are you going to become a new supplier for the brewery industry?
Look, there's a huge aftermarket. Like the barrels, I think new, that cost me $288. The aftermarket's like $253 today. They're traded pretty heavily, so you can just literally, if you wanted to, you can trade those in. But if I got 250 barrels that I'm done with, I trade those in for 250 new ones, or I could probably do it myself, or I go through a broker and sell them, you know, mm-hmm. other yeah. brewers or anybody else that wants a used bourbon barrel.
Yeah. yeah. So if you think about it, you know, 20 years ago, brewers weren't using barrels like they are now. So that market wasn't there. Mm-hmm. Most of the bourbon barrels, they're single-use barrels for bourbon. You mm-hmm. can't reuse them for bourbon. They have to be a first-use barrel. That's one of the, that's what, you know, one of the requirements to
Why
call
is
it
that?
Bourbon.
Because it, I mean, the alcohol in the bourbon has killed anything, but why can't you use it again?
It's a legal definition of
oh, really?
What, you know, if you want to call it bourbon, it has to be a first use barrel. So that's why.
Ah,
so it's just a legal.
Okay. That's a
so most of the, most of those barrels, most of those barrels went to other whiskey distillers like Canadian whiskey companies and a lot have gone to, I want to say Scotland for scotch and mm. Ireland for, so about 10 years ago, I tried to get some Maker's Mark barrels mm. and I called the Maker's Mark distillery and they said 100% of our barrels are contracted to Lafroig scotch.
Yeah. Really?
And,
let me get that straight then. So they put
Maker's Mark is
bourbon. Into the fresh barrel when they finish with it and they've emptied it out, then they take that barrel and they send it off to Scotland because they're able to use used barrels,
right.
but we can't here.
Right.
Okay.
Well, you can here, but you can't make bourbon with it.
Right. So they're not making bourbon, they're making whiskey.
Well, bourbon is whiskey, but
it is?
It's a specific type of whiskey.
Oh, that's either that or this Cherry's Jubilee. I don't know.
That's a good I don't think they're shipping all their barrels over there now. I think the brewers here in the States are paying more than Lafroig
yeah.
was.
Yeah, that's kind of interesting. So let's see. We have the vodka, the gin, the bourbon, the rye whiskey. What are we missing? Anything?
This summer, and we haven't made that decision yet, because, and Doris can speak to this better than I can, but our license is such that behind in our tasting room we can only sell what we make. We may delve into an agave, which is tequila, and we may make a spiced rum, only because we have customers are asking for a margarita, which I can't serve because I can't make an agave.
And you get a lot of pirates coming in.
I got a lot of pirates coming.
Rum.
They come here all the time. it's a real problem.
Yeah.
But so we haven't made a decision yet. I think I've given my distiller a heart attack when I said, you know, you need to start researching the fermentation of an agave and sugar cane for rum. And he says, you want me to do that when?
In 2 months.
Like now.
Yeah.
You know, so. Well, we have not made that decision yet. I'd like to get a rum, a spiced rum, and a agave in my tasting room so I can kind of complete.
Yeah.
I still won't have a whiskey until at least 2.5 years from now.
And wow.
It'd be a rye whiskey.
That's incredible, isn't it? Really, when you think about it.
Yeah.
I mean, you usually wait for like about a year for a really good beer to come out that's been sitting in a barrel. But having to wait, what was that, 5 years? Or 3.5?
I have a lot of patience.
Yeah. Okay, Doc.
So you mentioned the tasting room here. And we didn't touch on this very much, but the finish here is really, really nice. A lot of leather, really high ceiling. It's really a sophisticated finish here, and it's a really nice place to sit and have a drink.
I think you're right. This is kind of a cross between a brewery tap room and a cocktail bar, I guess I should say.
Yeah, right.
But we'll come back and talk in just a second, because I'm running out of Cherry's Jubilee. I'm dying to try the fourth one.
Phil, I just wanted to add one more thing as far as the name, Cherry's Jubilee. As soon as Don told me it was going to be a cherry chocolate, the first thing that came to mind was the Cherry's Jubilee dessert. And we have a daughter-in-law named Jubilee. So that went perfectly together,
oh,
so that's
excellent.
Where the Cherry's Jubilee comes
from. Cool. Was she born in the Queen's Jubilee year?
She was not.
How did that come about? That's a really unusual name.
It is an unusual name, but I think her parents were just jubilous about her birth is
all right.
What I
understand. Well, I'm certainly having a jubilee moment here with this beer, so we'll come back in a second.
Okay, sounds great.
Work for my daddy, oh. Work for my daddy, oh. There's whiskey in the jar.
Doris has come back with next samples, the final ones for this podcast anyway, and it had a definite strawberry tinge to it, and she was alluding to the strawberry blonde factor in the family.
Well, that is a good one.
And this one is called?
This is the Farmer's Basket.
Okay.
It has a 4.5% alcohol content in it,
okay.
And it has the Galaxy hops.
And this is a?
This is a Goza.
Okay. When I sniffed it, I said, there's definitely some fruitiness going on in here. Definitely strawberry. Did you get that, Ken?
Yeah.
And
fruitiness.
I said, I wonder how this is going to taste. So let's give it a little sip here and see what we got.
Got a little hibiscus in it, too.
Mm-hmm.
Mm.
I'm reading the description. I did not perceive that.
Oh, man. So, gozas are supposed to be salty. That is salty and... The best way I can describe my impression of this is that I got the sweetness from the strawberry, and then all of a sudden I got hit with the saltiness.
Mm-hmm.
But again, very crisp and very refreshing.
Yeah, a little sour.
Little
nice,
sour. Yeah,
nice sourness. Not, you know, mouth-ripping sour by any means.
As one of our co-hosts delicious. Would say, Mark Naske, oh yeah, do you want to have another sip after you had that one? That's really good. He's from Finland. So. That's a good one. You can sip again after that,
yeah.
Which is what I want to do on this one. So while we were off mic, as they say, in the break, Rick, you were telling us about the building and some of the plaster moldings that we see up there, and he had an interesting story about it.
Yeah, so we had a man come into our into our distillery, and we were starting to build. We were starting to remodel, and he came to us, and he was dressed all in white. He was kind of. He had the plaster dust on him, and he
sure he wasn't a ghost.
He could have been. Okay. Could have been. Seriously, and he literally walked in, and the sun was behind him, and I couldn't see him very well. And he said, "I think I can help you guys." And I said, "Okay, who are you?" And the introduction of is Bill Schimmerhorn. I said, name meant nothing to me. And he said, "My great grandfather did the original plastering in this building." And I said, "Wow,
wow."
Wow. So he came in and he started, you know, applying his craft, which is ornamental plastering. And Doris and I watched him for a little bit, and we said, wow, he really knows what he's doing.
Yeah, as I look around, it's a very specific pattern that they have.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Is this a historic building?
I don't think it's registered historic building.
Correct.
Go ahead, Doris.
We did check that if it was on the historic registry, and it's not, but certainly is a very historic building in and of itself, and there's crown molding all the way around the top. That's all original.
Mm-hmm.
There's pillars, and there's the faces on the corner booths, you know, from the original construction of the theater, and all of that was maintained because he was actually able to correct anything that was decayed or deteriorated. And so we were very fortunate that way. We were able to keep much more of it than I think we would have had Bill not come into our lives and been able to
to rebuild a lot of things that we didn't think that we could rebuild.
Mm.
And he worked day and night, usually mm-hmm. weekends, but just as you work, and it's kind of an interesting story, he's a non-union worker. Mm. All my other workers were union, and there was the first 2 weeks, there was exactly. Exactly. So, same thing I said, uh-oh. But within a couple of weeks, the union workers that were here, they said, you don't know what a talent you have.
Actually, I said, absolutely, we do know. Yeah.
I think you said during the break, he actually has some of the molds from his grandfather.
Yeah. He does.
Yeah.
Yes.
He had some of the original molding. And that's how we were able to rebuild a lot of the things was his original molding.
So. And that still maintains a feeling of an old theater.
I think
that detail gives it that. You come in and you go, yeah, I can see how people would sit here and enjoy a play
or something.
You know,
I can't overstate how cool it is that this is out here in Rochelle. You know, people really should come check this out. And it's worth coming out to see this.
Well,
it's pretty cool.
It's from Hot Vine, it's about 55 minutes.
Mm. Yeah.
And straight out on 88, no problem. Beautiful trip in the summer.
Thank you.
In the winter, watch out for the
snow. It's warm in here.
Well, and that's how we
met.
That's how we met Ken. I mean, he found us, and we had a nice conversation one night when he was here visiting, and you know, started to talk about what we had in common and about his place at Hot Vine, and so it was really an interesting and fun, you know, somebody to meet. That
in the last segment, I said I wanted to find out where you keep the barrels, because I think, if I remember rightly from doing the research on you, you built a whole barrel storage building.
A rick house?
What's it called?
A rick house.
A rick house. Is it named after you?
No. It's originally was called a rack house, but over the last several centuries, the word rack has somehow evolved into the word rick.
It's
so now everybody calls them a rick house.
But that's an official.
Don't let him fool you, Phil. He's excited that a building's named after him. So.
So that's an official term then, the rick house.
The rick house. Yes.
Okay.
So everybody calls them a rick house.
In there, and I think it's quite big, right? How many square foot?
22,000.
22,000 square foot. Okay. That's almost as big as your brewery, isn't it, Ken?
Yeah.
Oh, no, that's 2,200 square feet. Sorry.
And you brought him out here.
I'm kidding. Yeah. So
it's right behind here, Phil. It's right
is it
back,
okay.
Like right back across.
Oh, back there, okay. Mm-hmm. Oh, as
we're pointing, you can see that on the
recording. Yeah, I know. You can see it on the podcast. So let me see if you can describe. He pointed out into the distillery area, and there is what looks to be like a royal box that's up above a doorway that goes out, and it's got like curtains on it and everything. Was that a box?
It was, yes.
It's facing away from... Where was the stage then?
Behind it. In all honesty, we can't explain why it was positioned that way, and I haven't found anyone yet to tell me that.
For people who didn't want to watch the play.
They definitely could see the band pit that was there originally, so they could look down on that.
They could, yes, because in those days you'd have a real live band, right?
Yes.
Did you have an organ by any chance?
Yes, there was an organ here at one time, and there was also down beneath the stage what they called the... What they call it, Doris?
There was the green room.
Kissing room.
The kissing room.
Oh. The actors and actors would practice kissing down below the stage, and then they'd come up the stage and put on their performance. So the kissing room was down below. We tried to salvage it, but it was such a state of disrepair, we just couldn't.
Well, obviously a lot went on in there other than kissing. But now where the stage was, you have... The doors that come up for deliveries and things, is that
correct?
Right?
Correct, yes.
Okay. So, in the Rick House, back to the Rick House.
Yes.
I know that Goose Island down in Chicago, they have a large barrel house, and basically it's just rows and rows and rows of these racks, right, with the barrels on. That's what you've got there.
It is.
Okay.
We have both the barreling and bottling facility back there. So there's a separate room with just our bottling operation.
So for the bottling, for breweries, you have mobile canning lines, you have people who install a canning line themselves, a small one, you have bottling, and we did bring a bottle of our Wicked Googly for your pleasure, to thank you for giving us some time
here,
which was the Riverlands Hot Vine Britain Yankee Standing By Asking Questions collaboration, and that's the barley wine. So you're bottling the spirits. Can you adapt that to bottle beer? Say you wanted to do that in the future.
I would say no. That would be a different operation.
Yeah, I don't think we can. I don't think so.
If we do the beer at some point, it would probably be crowlers.
Okay. Okay, I was going to ask whether you did Crowell's or not. So for the, I'm looking at some bottles over there behind the bar. It does look to be a different top on it. Do you have, like, is it a cork in it or is it a screw or what?
It is a cork.
It's a cork, okay. I don't know of a beer that has a cork in it. Well, there's a couple that have a cork and a cap, right?
Cork yeah. and a, there's cork and cage.
Cork and cage.
In, beer, in the yeah, beer world. True. But I don't know about, you know, a wrap like that.
Hmm.
I'm not sure. But I'm sure that the fact that that's not under pressure, it's a different bottling procedure than, you know, beer that's got carbonation in it.
Okay, so back to the Rickhouse. How many barrels in 20 can you put in a 22,000 square foot minus the canning line?
if we stack seven high, which we can, because we've already done it, we can get right at 5,000 barrels. And we'd like to do 1,000 barrels a year.
1,000 a year. So you would have in 5 years' time, once that first 5 years has gone by, then it, you know,
then we
it's
start
consistently
the
moving,
yes.
right?
Yes. So exactly.
Distilling is definitely a long-term project.
Exactly.
Yeah. And as you said, you have a lot of patience. Right?
I've been told that.
So what did you find when you opened this place that was perhaps something you didn't expect?
Everything. You know, the building process was fun and exciting. The manufacturing, the design was fun. What's been unexpected is the distribution process. And we must sell outside of this
facility.
Four walls, and it's challenging. It's political. It's just
frustrating.
Frustrating, thank you. Yeah. You just have to sell out these walls. And once it leaves my possession, you know, this is my baby. This is something I raised from an infant. I no longer have control of it. I don't know how it's going to be shelved. I don't know how it's going to be priced. I don't know how it's going to be
marketed.
And so it's you know, you just have to deal with all that. It's
you want to be everywhere at every place telling your story. And telling about your product and why it's so wonderful. And there's so many of us, few, and you just can't be everywhere that you need to be. And you can't find enough people to be those ambassadors yet. Someday I think it'll be like a snowball where it keeps building on itself. But it's literally one bottle, one cocktail at a time. And so that's probably the most limiting thing we've ever had in our lives, because we've always been the people that go out and get it and do it and make it happen. And so there's certain limits in doing that. And so it's
seriously, like my goal is to convince one person every single day that I have the best vodka on the market. If I can get one person and that person tells another person, now we've got two. And they tell two. Now we got four, so it truly is one bottle at a time.
So how do you tell what is a good vodka? I mean, I've heard there is rock guts, and then there's Russian vodkas, and then there's the Russian Tea Room down in Chicago who does flights of horseradish vodka and other stuff like that. What makes a good vodka?
Our vodka started off with a testimonial. We you know, we're tempted. We wasn't sure, but as we introduced our vodka to people, as they came through my doors, they said, you know, this is really good. And then I started thinking, okay, what's the process? Why is this really good? Why are so many people telling me this is really good? And then we started going, well, there's two parts of the story. We started going outside these four walls and just selling it, you know, at the grocery store. And same comments. This is really good vodka. So now my confidence is boosted a little bit. And then I started thinking, and so I started to go through the process, and it starts with my own grain. I can hand select it. It's a high starch, low, you know, foreign material, because I can screen all that off and feed all that stuff. It can go right to my cattle. So we screen it, clean it, So only the, you know, really high starch comes here. And then if you notice, I know it's we're on a podcast, you can't see, but all my fermenters are closed tops and my beer wells closed top. That's very rare in the industry. Everything's closed, so I can control everything. It doubles the cost of your tanks. But there's no foreign dust, there's no foreign yeast, there's nothing comes in that we can't control. Plus, we also have specially designed tanks that we designed ourselves. We can, I'm going to not use too many terms here, we can heat it up and crash cool it very quickly. We can heat the water up, cook it, and then we can crash cool it within a few hours. We have big coolers. So we can control the cooling process. It's not, it doesn't take 24 hours to cool. We can cool ours in just a few hours. Mm. So we control it there. And then as we get, and all that said, we have a very experienced distiller. He really, 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 really knows a lot about yeast. So we can control the yeast for flavor, not so much for yield, but for flavor. And it's just it's the whole process from start to finish. I know I've been told enough times that our vodka and our gin is very unique and it's very good. The word smooth gets used a lot.
Mm-hmm. Word sweet comes out.
Sweet comes out a lot.
Which I liken to sweet corn. You know, it's 100% corn. So what's the first thing that comes to your mind is sweet, buttery corn, you know? And, you know, Adam has a biology and chemistry degree. So, you know, just the process, he knows what he's doing.
I was looking at the notes here on your website, and he held a degree from NIU, right?
He did.
So he's a Husky.
He's a Husky.
There we go. So we're kind of running on here a little bit, but that's okay because, you know, it's a podcast. We can go as long as we like. But I did want to ask, what does the future hold for you? And it almost sounds like you've answered that question, and it's a lot more waiting.
A lot more waiting.
You got any plans?
In the meantime, I've got a pretty calculated plan in my mind. We've got to get our distribution set up so that if I can facilitate the first bottle and maybe even the second bottle with myself, you know, being there as the consumer, the end consumer is buying their product. But it's that repeat customer. And that will allow me to go to the next set of stores, is my plan. I don't know if I've made that perfectly clear, but if I can get a person to buy a second, maybe even a third bottle, and then that allows me to move on and get another set of customers introduced to our product, because I believe and I know it's true that our vodka is the best vodka and the best gin on the market.
So I guess my final question is this easier than farming?
Years ago, Phil, I asked Rick, this is early in our marriage, and you know, there's trials and tribulations with every industry, but we had a rough farming year, and I said to him, why do you want to do this year after year? And his answer to me was, because I still get excited when that crop pops out of the ground. And of course, I had to do the big sigh, because I was like, oh shoot, I can't even argue with that. And I think distillation is, you know, now that we've got this new crop, it's the same way. We're so excited about what we're making and that it's great and that it's family. And, you know, we just want everybody to know about it. Obviously, we want to be successful. And I'll add one more story. Many, many years ago, when we signed our first loan at the First National Bank of Rochelle, been with the same bank, it's now Central Bank. But they started to describe the word default, what default meant. Ooh. And I looked at him really funny, like, why are you telling me this? And he said, well, you know, it's just part of the process. When you sign a loan, you need to know all the aspects of it. And I remember looking at the banker and saying, that's not even in our vocabulary.
Yeah.
The word fail isn't in our vocabulary. So that's how we feel about this project here. I mean, this is something that will be successful because we believe in it.
This endeavor is the Apollo 13 of distilleries. Failure is not an option.
It is not an option.
I like that.
Well, thank you so much indeed for your time.
You.
We've finished our strawberry ghosts, but you still got some. At the end of the shows all the time, I say it's good night from me.
And good night from him.
And good night from you guys. Right. And thank you so much and cheers.
Thank
cheers.
You.
That
cheers.
Was fun.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, Ken. Maybe we can get some of the hard stuff now.
A little bit of that vodka.
Oh, yeah. I'm up for a gin and tea.
It's the best vodka.
G&T with a little slice of lemon.
Oh. We can do that.
Don't need no lemon.
Britain Yankee!
Britain Yankee!
I'll have a pint. No, go, give us a pint. You got any tetanus?
A pint, please, Bob. Give another pint, please, Bob.